Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier. Game on. Soccer.
Now to soccer, and former Republic of Ireland international John O'Shea joins us on the line. John, how are you?
Evening, Marie. Yeah, all good. Thanks.
Good.
And yourselves?
Ah, we're all good here. Well, I don't know, myself and Donegal aren't getting on too great today, but we're going to try and power through. Ruby's acting like the referee.
There's a rift in the camp.
There's a rift.
Oh, well, there's no better man to solve it.
You know all about that this weekend when Manchester was divided, wasn't it?
It was, but thankfully it came out red in the end, thankfully.
Now, John, before we get on to the Premier League, we are going to talk about the FAI because, as I'm sure you know, the crisis is worsening every passing day. The latest blow was the revelations in the accounts on Friday. The amount of debt the FAI are in is absolutely staggering. Just wondering, what are your thoughts on the state that the association is in right now?
Yeah, look, it's obviously not pretty, and that's obviously an understatement. The reports came out just beforehand that the figures weren't going to be nice, but obviously when they did come out, the actual total figure was, it's quite staggering, really, and it shows the amount of work that's going to have to go into getting everything back into line and back into the people's confidence of what they think the FAI should be, you know, and what it stands for. And it's going to be tough, but thankfully, I'd hope it can only go higher, if you know what I mean. Things can only improve, you know. So, in that sense, it's believe me, a very, very small positive that the only way it can go is improve and get better.
Are you concerned about the future of Irish football, John?
No, I don't think so, because I think I would have to say the majority of people that I've ever dealt with and been involved with in teams, being selected for the Irish team under 15 and obviously being involved from coaches from Ferrybank and Bowes and Waterford and stuff like that, there's amazing people working in football, so I don't think we should be worried about the future of it in that sense. I think there's amazing people that are willing to work there and put in the work and put in honest work, and if we can get behind them and get the right support in place, that it will improve and will get better again.
And we hope it does, because it is a sorry state of affairs for all those people at the grassroots level. But we will move on to Manchester and the red half taking over the blue half again, John.
He's delighted.
Which was the highlight of the weekend, without doubt.
You should have heard him last week, John. He was slagging off United.
Look, I think when they put in that performance against Tottenham, it was very pleasing. But then the big question was, you're coming up against a different animal in Manchester City at the Etihad. And what could they do? Could they back it up? And let's be honest about it, they could have been out of sight nearly at half time. It could have been 3 or 4 nil at half time. You know, I think City are maybe the one they showed against Burnley. I thought they had maybe turned a bit of a corner because they had been looking a little bit shaky, but then they go and hammer Burnley. And then I thought, right, United they didn't hammer Tottenham, but they really dominated against Tottenham. And then this was going to be a big acid test, and they flew past us with flying colours.
Like, when you look at United's record against City, Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal, Spurs, Leicester, they've competed in all those games, but yet against Cardiff, Palace, Newcastle, they lost. They drew with Huddersfield and Rochdale.
Yeah.
Like, they don't take their chances in the small games, yet they seem to take them against the bigger teams.
It's crazy, isn't it? It's crazy. And I think, as well, it just so happens, it's like as if it's suiting United to play against the so-called bigger teams in the sense, and then against the smaller teams, because they sit back. United can't use that blistering pace that they have, and they use it so devastatingly against City. You know, Rashford obviously is in really top form at the minute. Martial looked as if he fancied it. And then obviously Daniel James, Lingard's coming back to form. And then obviously the defence had to stand up for the last 10-15 minutes against Tottenham and against City, and they were able to do it.
Yeah, John, just on that, like, you've shared a dressing room with Ollie. Like, how does that happen? Because that's not his mindset, is it?
As in what?
Ruby's point there, that they can lift it for all the big teams, the Spurs, the Man City. It's like, it is Man United after all.
No, they are. In my head, I think they're preparing probably even more for the so-called smaller teams in the Premier League, because they realise they have to, and it's just not coming off for them, because obviously maybe that extra bit of quality whether it needs to come from someone at the back or someone in midfield, that the other team seem to have at the minute, that United still are maybe just lacking a small bit. They're improving greatly, and there's still a bit of inconsistency because they have a lot of younger players still playing. And if they can just get that little bit of mixture in with the experience, I think to help them out in January, there's some amazing, amazing positives for United fans, I think, this season.
John, by all accounts, Roy Keane went in to give them a bit of a team talk over the last few days. What would Roy Keane say in a team talk now, do you think, to Manchester United?
It would have been colourful, I'd imagine. No, look, it would have been very precise. And a lot of, obviously, Roy, knowing him for so many years, it would have been very simple and clear and to the point. And it's getting the... Your past appreciation, your touch, your control, then looking forward, looking positive, wanting to play positive passes. Don't be taking soft options. Don't be taking easy options. You're at Manchester United to win. You're at Manchester United to compete. Don't be scared of all those things. And it would have been a reminder of all that and what it takes to face these games and what it takes to have the responsibility of wearing that shirt.
You probably just didn't tell him to go and watch Liverpool and look what Jurgen Klopp is doing, because that's positive football, and look what they did at the weekend again.
He actually said on the telly the other night, or yesterday, we all know how difficult it is to win three Premier Leagues.
Nice.
Well, look, it's one of them. If you're looking at Liverpool, no matter what team or selection he's making as well at the minute, they just seem to be, obviously, they're in that confident mode. Changing teams, changing resting players. Mane's left out, Alexander Arnold left out this weekend. Salah was left out beforehand. You know, they're really in a confident moment. And look, it's an incredible lead they have, and Leicester seem to be the ones who are trying to keep pace with them. And I think they played them soon enough too, don't they? I think it's on Stephen's Day maybe. So it's an incredible situation for Liverpool to be in. And they really have to be strong, strong favourites to finish it off this year.
In three games in 7 days, Brighton, Everton and Bournemouth, only Van Dijk played the full minutes, which is unbelievable. And they had seven different scorers in that time. It has to come down to good management, though, as well, John, doesn't it?
Ah, totally, it does. And that's the confidence you give. I think when, obviously, there was a few eyebrows raised for his team selection against Everton in a derby game. But then the display of the players, that Origi, Shaqiri, can't remember who else. There was a couple, I think he might have played Lallana,
Keita,
and even against Bournemouth as well, the goal, the assist from Salah, that finish. You know, they really are in a confident mood, and he's obviously testing the squad beforehand because he knows it's going to be really needed with the amount of games they have. I think they were going to be playing 10 or 11 games in the space of 30 days with the World Club Championships coming up as well. So it was a perfect time to really test the squad, and they've come through with flying colours so far.
Have players' mindset changed, John, in terms of you want to be a part of a squad now? You know that, like, players like yourself, if you weren't playing every week, you'd get frustrated and annoyed, where team players nowadays seem to be happy to be a part of a winning squad.
The key word you said there was winning. And that's what makes it very, not very easy, but a lot easier for managers to change the team around. And to say to a player, like Sir Alex used to say to us, right, you're playing this week, but I'm going to leave you out this week, but you're playing against Arsenal next week, or you're playing in the Champions League next week. You can kind of plan that bit ahead. And while the player's not happy, he somehow kind of obviously accepts it because the team's winning, you're in a good moment. And that's where you go. If you look at all the teams that are successful, if you any league in Europe or around the place, they have to have big squads because, look at Liverpool, they only have that 10, 11, 12 games, 30 days, something crazy. So to maintain that performance level, you have to have a fully fit squad, hopefully, and then a quality players to replace quality that are starting in the team.
John, from an Irish perspective, we saw Troy Parrott make his Premier League debut over the weekend. How big a deal is it to see an Irish kid, 17 years old, go out and play for Spurs in the Premier League?
It's huge. It really is huge, obviously. After seeing him kind of up close now in for the Irish game and making his debut and now making his Premier League debut, I think the momentum can like, obviously there's a lot of hype beforehand, but I think Mourinho obviously has seen something in training, whether it be his personality, his physicality also, because you're not going to be able to play in the Premier League if you're not physically able to cope with it. Obviously Pochettino had him in training with the first team for a good few months too, so Mourinho's obviously been impressed. And if you're impressing Mourinho and Pochettino, yeah, you must be doing something right. So fingers crossed he stays fit and healthy. I'm sure he'll get a bit more game time over the Christmas period, and it could be a real big boost for Ireland coming into March.
Does that show how much Mourinho's changed? When he signed first for Spurs, everyone was nervous that, you know, that Troy Parrott might have to go out on loan, whereas Mourinho's given him his head and putting him out there.
Yeah, and I think, look, he'll know as well, Mourinho, the kind of bit more scrutiny that he's under. When he's gone into teams, people have said he's not really looked at the youth setup and the younger players coming through. So maybe he... And ultimately, look, as much as his words when he says, I think when his first day, when he took the Tottenham job, he spoke about the academy and the younger players, etc. And obviously a lot of people would have just thought that was just a bit of a smokescreen. He likes the older, experienced players. But if a player stands out, like hopefully Troy Parrott is doing, that it just takes care of itself. And Harry Kane is going to need that competition, bit of a rest here and then. And if Troy Parrott can get the benefit of that and showcase his talents, it's going to be huge for Ireland.
John, thanks a million. If you have Jose's number, give him a shout there and see if you can get Troy a better number than 52, will you? Thanks a million.
You don't like that squad number?
No, it's desperate. Game on, soccer. I got put in place here as well. Tell Ruby the 52 of Troy Parrott's is 5 plus 2 equals 7. So 52 does have a meaning.
Can I ask, if you had to have a squad number, what would it be? Crow?
9.
No.
Oh, glory hunter. Goal scorer, stood at the front there, just tapping him in.
Obviously.
What about a real jersey, like 5, 4, 5, 6?
Yeah, I'd take a 4 or 18.
You were a 4.
You were glad to get 4 and everything, haven't you?
I was going to go for 18. What about you, Ruby?
Me?
Yeah.
What number would I like?
Yeah.
Probably 5 or 6.
I thought you'd go 10.
No, I would have said 6. Now, to football.
Or 16.
Why are you looking at me like that
for? 16.
16, okay, yeah, you can have that. Now, football fans are going to be in for a treat tonight, because at 9:35 on RT1, there's a super documentary set to air called In League with Gaddafi. And we are delighted to have the director, Kevin Branigan, in studio with us. Kevin, you're very welcome to Game On.
Delighted to be here, thank you.
What's your sporting highlight of the weekend?
Oh,
my sporting
question.
Highlight of the weekend, I suppose Michael Darragh-McCauley coming on for Ballyboden. I'm not from Ballyboden, but I just really like Michael Darragh-McCauley and I like seeing him do well.
Oh, good. Yeah, that was a good one.
Did you not see Fiddler's Family, Kevin? Like, he's a brave man. Mona McSherry ripped a tire around the place.
He's getting paid by the mention.
We are not plugging your show anymore. We are here to plug.
We're going to find him.
We're going to put a Too Talented Christmas special.
Put a cup on the table, and every time you mention it from now on, he's going to put a fiver in it.
Okay, let's do that.
I'm done.
Or else we'll tell him that he can't have his dinner. Okay, we're going to hear about Kevin's show.
League of Ireland news, Bohemians and St. Patrick's Athletic are heading off to Colonel Gaddafi's Libya.
It may not have been the brightest thing that anyone ever did in football.
I'm a bad guy. Duh.
Gaddafi was at that time a world figure, and he was painted as the devil himself.
Put the boys in the better land.
10,000 tons, it's twice our largest ever Libyan beef order.
Have you supplied weapons to the IRA?
Norwich Selected was called to go over and play. I think it was 80,000 people decided.
There was fellas on horses, hiding machine guns.
I think they might have been spun a bit of a story that was the Irish international team were coming.
In League with Gaddafi, Monday at 9:35 on RTE1.
So Kevin, that is your documentary. I saw it. It's absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
Tell us, how did you come up with the idea?
I come up with the idea, I suppose, first off, because I'm a Bowes fan. And
I was wondering how long it was going to take you to say that first answer. Well done.
First answer. And as you know, like, a lot of Bowes matches and a lot of football matches in general are quite boring. But thankfully that the people I go to games with and stand around with, they always have something interesting to say. So for most of the matches, we just chat away. And one day, it must have been back in like 2013 or something like that, I think Bo's friend of mine, Patter, he told me, did you ever hear of this game that took place between Bo's and Libya back in the 80s under Colonel Gaddafi? And I didn't really believe him. And then we went into the bar, and hanging up above the bar, there's this like green plate with Arabic writing on it and a sword going across it. And I was like, that was the present that was gifted to Bo's for taking part in the match. And my interest was obviously peaked then. And I wrote an article for a magazine, and then spent the next kind of up until last October looking for this VHS tape that every player who was on the trip said they had but couldn't find. And it was just one day I was kicking around town and I got a phone call off Pat Fenlon, Expos Pat, he's now managing director up in Linfield, I think. But I got a phone call off Pat and he was like, I've just found the VHS going through my attic. And I hopped on the Lewis, got it off him, and from there we were able to make the documentary.
It's a really, really good watch, like, but I still can't figure out how they played the match before they got the bag of cash.
Before they got the bag of cash, exactly, yeah. Like, the whole reason they seem to have ended up in Libya was because they were just so absolutely broke that they would have went anywhere to do anything. And also because Brian Kerr is just a bit of a buzzer and wanted an adventure, as your dad will probably know. And but they played the match before they got the cash, and that's kind of, like, it's a caper and it's a heist story, and, it's got a bit of a twist at the end.
Oh, it does, and it's even like to go through how it was funding the two teams, Bo's and Pat's, and the adventure for the lads to go on, and to listen to them sit, the two guys sitting in the bar talking about it, and the taxi driver. It's a really, really good watch.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing I wanted to do was show that, like, you know, League of Ireland players, they're not like, you know, footballers. League of Ireland players definitely in the 80s are not like the footballers we'd know today, even League of Ireland players today. Like, there were lads who were doing 9-to-5 jobs. Most of them are doing backbreaking jobs, you know, working on the council, being a butcher, you know, manual labour jobs. But they were still able to have these big adventures in their life, and they were still able to go off and do, like, really, you know, interesting and cool things.
And, like, they're talking about going to find their passports, or to go and get a passport so they could go to Libya and head off on this adventure in the late 80s. And then, what way was it sold? They were half sold that there was the Irish team that was coming.
Well, that's the thing. When I started interviewing the lads who I interviewed in the film, there was always this thing in the background that when they landed in Benghazi, the local press was like, where's Ronnie Whelan? Where's Ronnie Whelan? Because obviously Ronnie had scored the shinner against the Soviet Union in Euro 88 a couple of months beforehand, and he would have been known for being the big, you know, Liverpool player who was sweeping around Europe at the time. And everyone kept saying, that's him, that's him, that's him. But I wasn't really too sure how true it was until I interviewed the two Libyan lads who you see in the film, Khalid and Captain Ali. And they come out with a line of like, you know, you see these people on the TV and every now and again, and next thing you're standing 5-10 metres from them. But they were standing 5-10 metres from Pat Fenlon and Johnny Mack, not Ronnie.
It's a great watch. And then when they realise during the match that number 12 is actually the best player they have, and all they want to do is nobble him.
Some great
shots at him, like just taking the legs completely out of number 12.
It was lovely getting to interview the two Libyan lads in it, because they look back at it, like, obviously Libya's gone through a tragic history in the last decade or so, but they look back at it with real warmth. You know, I didn't burst their bubble that it wasn't the Irish team that they played, the Euro 88 Irish team. I let them still believe that, but everyone seemed to have fun, and like there's like 50,000 people at the stadium as well.
And did Brian Kerr ever tell you the real story of how they got out of the prison when they got locked up for drinking in the place out in the desert?
Brian negotiated the lad's release, and that was the official statement.
I thought we were going to get a scoop down, Marie.
Johnny McDonald said in it that Brian had a knack of bringing them to places that were troubled.
I suppose what he meant by that was Brian would be very much of, like, you know, hands over the border kind of thing, and he used to bring his teams up to the north at the height of the troubles in the late 80s and play against teams from mainly loyalist areas like Glentoran and Linfield and stuff like that. He was trying to build bridges, Brian. But also Brian has just a real sense of adventure, and he ended up taking teams to Tunisia, to Iran during the Iran-Iraq war, and also a year after that they get a match against Steaua Bucharest, but it's only about 2 weeks after Ceausescu has fallen, and the lads are saying that, and there's a clip of that in the film as well, when the lads are saying you can hear the guns going off in the background, and they literally just streets are littered because, you know, there's the fall of the Ceausescu regime. And Brian, he's kind of like that Rolling Stones song, you know, Sympathy for the Devil. He just keeps popping up in these places.
The atmosphere at the match looked absolutely amazing, and a few of the lads in the dock said they'd never played anything like it.
They had definitely never played in a match that was preceded by a 3-hour military parade in honour of Colonel Gaddafi. That wasn't happening in Richmond Park or Dailymount Park every second week, you know. But the atmosphere looks incredible. Some of them actually didn't actually really remember the match, so I don't know how that was possible, you know. But
listen to some of their accounts, like when the four different guys are jazzed, it goes from 80,000 to 70,000 to 60,000. But I think there was 50,000 there.
Yeah.
It's just how, and even they say themselves when they came back, how the story just grew legs and got better and better. But it's brilliant. It's really good.
The bag of cash, what did they get it changed to? Because it was in local currency.
Well, Libya at the time was not really the place where you would be going on holidays, and it was a bit of a, you know, it was kind of like on the enemy number one watch list for the West. So Libyan currency, dinar, wasn't really too accepted in Dublin at the time. So that's kind of like, you know, after they played the match, it's a run around Tripoli looking to try and piece together some sterling and some dollars. But, you know, they got a bit of cash, but I think it was mainly adventure that drove them there as well.
But think about it, like, they've played the game, they have no ransom. Surprised they got any cash at all. The game is over at this stage.
It probably involved Brian doing a bit more negotiating, you know.
He did some job.
Kev, we've some great characters in the league here in Ireland over the years, and you seem to have direct lines to a lot of them.
Yeah, it's a Ouija board or something I have. I've been knocking around doing League of Ireland TV production for like a long time, so I'd know all the lads, and I'd hear all these stories in passing. And I really think in the league, it's a really rich league that we've delved into GAA, we've delved into rugby to an extent, but we've delved into, like, you know, the Jack Charlton glory years and stuff like that, but we definitely haven't delved into the stories that are in the League of Ireland. Like, there's one story of UCD going on a friendly and ended up in Africa, and the match being called off because of machine guns and stuff on the pitch. And if anyone's listening, don't steal that idea on me, because that could be the next one. But yeah, there's some real great characters in the league, because, you know, these are all ordinary men basically doing ordinary lives and then doing this football on top of it. And a lot of people with a good sense of adventure in the league, but a lot of stories there too.
Kevin, with all these brilliant characters, these brilliant topics, will you do more docs?
Hopefully, yeah. You know, I just need Colm O'Callaghan and RTE just to keep commissioning them, you know, and I think they will, you know.
Yeah, definitely after this one, they will. Just, we'll go back to what the league was like then, because I think it gave an insight into how difficult it was. Your doc gave an insight into how difficult it was in Ireland at that stage. Mm.
Well, I suppose the thing, when you're making a documentary, you see a lot of footage that you don't use, and you go through a lot of newspaper reports and stuff. And I was like, you know, going to college and stuff, the line in journalism class was, if it bleeds, it leads, you know. And then you're looking at news reports from Ireland in the 80s, and it's not leading with all the deaths from that day, because there were so many. And it just seemed like, I was born in 88, but it just seemed like a really grim time, you know. And to have any sort of an outlet by being able to play football and stay in the country and stuff like that seemed like a really good escape for these lads as well, you know. But Eamon McCann went against my theory. He's interviewed in the documentary as well. He went against my theory that it was a grim time. He thought it was a great time. He was like, we're just having a lot of fun. Eamon actually ended up interviewing Gaddafi about 3 times, and was, as a Derry City fan. But the league, I kind of maybe gets painted a little bit grimly in the documentary that you'll see tonight. But 89 was also the year that Derry City entered and brought big crowds and stuff like that. And that's another big story. But yeah, Ireland was definitely a different place, where teams had to end up going to Libya to get a bit of cash. But I think it was an apt weekend as well to be talking about dictators in Irish football.
We can't say what we were going to say.
Where did we go?
You've ruined Ruby's point with that throwaway.
All right, sorry. I read his notes.
No. What I was going to say, the next comment I was going to make, I now realise I can't make.
Right. Okay, we're going to move on, because you have, it's not your first documentary as well. Tell us about some of the other ones you've made, Kev.
The one I made last year was Cares Kids, and it was about Brian's youth teams of the late 90s. Also, it was around the time that the rugby teams were breaking through as well, with Brian O'Driscoll and stuff on the under 21s team and that. But Brian's youth teams of the late 90s, which, like, you know, John O'Shea, Richie Sadler, though I keep name checking Richie, though he didn't have as great a career as John O'Shea or Damien Duff or Robbie Keane. But yeah, Brian can centre point a lot to build a documentary around, you know. And it was while we were making the doc with Cares Kids that was like, Brian, we're going to make a trilogy out of this. So we just need to find out what part 3 is.
John Kenny something or... Stephen Kenny, sorry.
Stephen Kenny something or... Yeah, Stephen Kenny's kids, you know. Why not? But I don't think he's going to be in charge for the under-21 World Cup. But yeah, flying the wall with Stephen Kenny, I think, would be quite good.
Aaron Connolly, Troy Parrott, etc.
Yeah,
it's
brilliant.
That, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I suppose, yeah, if you look at what Troy Parrott did this weekend, it really did, you know, show you that there can be some good shining stuff in bright stories in Irish football as well, not just the negativity.
Yourself and Brian Kerr must get on great.
I don't think so. I think Brian is a bit worried that I'm going to pester him again to do something else. So yeah, if Brian's listening, I'll leave him alone for now. Like,
but Kev, you see something in him, like us all. There's a kind of giddiness. There's a character there, isn't there?
Yeah, I love Brian. I love the way that like he just retains this sense of love for life and love for adventure and just doing stuff. And he also has the ability to, you know, lead groups of people, you know, be they young lads that include Robbie Keane or be they a group of lads who end up going to a war zone, you know. You'd follow him through hell kind of thing.
Didn't sound like he did much shite at times now, in all fairness.
Probably not, no.
When you watch tonight's documentary, you'll know what we mean.
Yeah.
So Kev, here's your chance. Plug the doc.
The doc is on RT1, the big leagues, 9:35 after the news and weather, I suppose. Is the weather still all about storms? But it's, 9:35 tonight on RT1.
Fantastic, and it's great, Ruby, isn't it?
It is, but it's very enjoyable to watch.
Can I just make a point before we let Kev go? Yeah. Ruby never likes anything. Look at this.
This is incredible.
This is the happiest I've ever seen him talking about anything. Actually,
that's a smile, Kev.
Thanks, Ruby. Ruby's won me a lot of money down there.
Normality has been restored in the Game On studio. Marie and Dunnick are ganging up on Ruby, and now it's time for a break. Game On
Soccer. Now, there was some news this evening that former Republic of Ireland international Daryl Murphy revealed that he secretly served an FA ban for taking cocaine on a night out. Daniel Taylor of The Athletic had this story this evening, and Daniel joins us on the line. Daniel, how did this story come to light?
Well, I heard about it a while back. It's not something that has been in the last few days. And to be honest, I think my initial reaction was probably the same as everybody else's, really, because obviously Daryl, you know, kind of always seen as, you know, great professional. You know, and I wouldn't really say one incident takes that away, forever, but obviously this does tarnish perhaps how, you know, that otherwise unblemished sort of record he has. You know, he's played for a lot of clubs. He's always, you know, I think when he retired from the Irish team, Martin Neil sort of praised him for his professionalism. And but obviously there was this incident, it was last season, and he's held his hands up and he's put a statement out via The Athletic, basically saying that it was a night out and he made a bad decision. And obviously in this day and age, I mean, you know, you can call it a bad decision. Other people would call it perhaps something slightly stronger when, you know, so many drug tests and, you know, how he thought I'm not too sure. So, yeah, you know, a really, really bad decision. And he actually served 6 weeks suspension, but it never came out at the time because the Football Association here has a policy which is that for anyone failing a drugs test, the FA keep it secret, which is fundamentally because most of the time it's young players, it's players of 16, 17. And they want to protect them when they've got their whole career ahead of themselves.
But is that right or wrong, Danny? Should they be protected 16, 17, 18? Is that not sort of saying we kind of accept this, we're going to give you a second chance? Should they not be standing on it?
I can see both views, to be fair. I mean, one of the other considerations is that they also say that sometimes for a player to have taken recreational drugs, it can point to, you know, them having personal difficulties in their life. In this case, that, you know, obviously, you know, I've been speaking to Bolton Wanderers and Daryl Murphy indirectly through Bolton, and Daryl Murphy's basically said that there aren't any other mitigating, so, you know, circumstances along those lines. So it just sounds basically like a night out where he was tempted to basically take some cocaine, and obviously, as a professional footballer, or a professional sportsman, that is an owner, you know. And I mean, at that time, the irony being that he was actually in really good form and in his team. But obviously, he missed a couple of months. I think the suspension was 6 weeks, but he was out of the team for 2 months. And obviously, yeah, it's so kind of unprofessional. But yet, we're talking about someone whose sort of reputation is for great professionalism. So that's the dynamic. With the FA, I can see both sides. I certainly wouldn't say you're wrong. You know, in terms of if you think that, you know, the players should be named, they're named. If they have a fight outside a chip shop on a Friday night and get arrested, they're named. So it just seems slightly strange that there's this kind of blanket policy, you know, to protect the players. And obviously, Daryl Murphy, you know, he's 36 now. You know, at the end of a very long career, as I say, he hasn't offered any kind of mitigating circumstances other than I've already said that it was just a night out, and he fancied doing some cocaine for whatever reason.
Thanks, Daniel. We really appreciate you taking the call, and I think this is something we might end up talking about a bit more tomorrow. But that's all we have time for tonight. Tara Stewart is up next.
Game on
2FM. Weekdays from 6.